Morning, ladies and gentlemen. First case for argument is Arpin v. United States. Mr. Cole.
May it please the court. I am William Cole from the U.S. Department of Justice. I am here with Mr. Jim Hipkus at counsel table, who tried this case as an assistant U.S. attorney. There are three issues that are presented to this court. First, in this malpractice action, did a second-year resident who treated the decedent, engage in malpractice when he failed to detect a rare disease?
She.
You're absolutely right. I'm sorry, Your Honor. Second question. That's the one issue that I will not be handling in this argument, thank goodness. The second issue is, did Dr. Haynes, her preceptor, who discussed the case with her, engage in malpractice? And the third question is whether the loss of consortium damages awarded were excessive.
May I start you right out, Mr. Cole?
Certainly.
Because what I'm trying to figure out is whether or not you challenged the district court's finding of fact that Mrs. Arpin advised Dr. Khan that she was worried about her husband's lack of appetite, that he was sweaty, clammy, had poor color, and that his pain was getting worse.
Your Honor, that is not an issue that I'm going to even address. I'm leaving that to the counsel for St. Louis University, who is seated at counsel table also there, Mr. Matt Zittel.
Okay.
The issue that I wish to bring to this court at this time is whether the preceptor who talked to the resident who saw the patient engaged in a malpractice. And our answer to that question is no. And it is because of something called the primary care exception that is recognized throughout the United States and certainly in the rules of practice at this clinic, at the St. Louis University Clinic. That governs resident physician liability in outpatient primary care. And it states that during the first 6 months in a residency program, doctors in these outpatient situations do have to bring in a preceptor to look at the patient and to confer about the question.
What kind of rule is this you're appealing to?
This is called the primary care exception.
Yeah, well, what is it? Is it a law?
It is not a law. It was testified to by government witnesses.
Huh?
What is it?
Yeah.
It is a rule that applies to those...
What is it? It's not a legal rule, so what is it?
It is a rule of medical practice that is recognized by the United States, for example, in the Medicare rules, which are in our appendix. According to Dr. Kamens, the U.S.
It's a custom in the
medical... It is a custom, and it was also recognized...
And what is the legal significance of a custom?
The custom is recognized in the St. Louis University rules.
Who cares about the St. Louis University rules? What is the legal significance of a custom, whether it's in a hospital's rules or not in the hospital's rules, right? Why would that make a difference?
Because this is a rule of conduct that is recognized by all doctors.
No, what's the legal significance of this rule of conduct recognized by all hospitals under Illinois law?
Under Illinois law, and I believe under every other jurisdiction.
But it doesn't matter every other. This matters Illinois, right? That's the applicable law.
I would suggest, Your Honor, that you cannot have malpractice where the conduct that is supposedly below the standard of care is recognized as being within the standard of care.
So you're saying the profession sets the standard of care, and that's binding on the courts.
Exactly. This is a standard of care for supervision of residents, and it is recognized throughout the country, and it was stated that was the rule in this case, and it was recognized in the rules at the clinic that were put together by St. Louis University. And it specifically indicated that following the first year of residency, the patient could leave before that patient's condition was even discussed by the resident with a member of the clinic
faculty.
Okay,
but didn't Captain Haynes, didn't he say that if he had been told by Dr. Khan that the patient's pain was getting worse and he, you know, might be feverish and so on, didn't he testify that he then would have examined the person?
Yes, he did. But that did not set a standard of care.
Well, wait a second. Forget the standard of care. So if he said he would have done that, and then the judge believes Dr. Khan or whoever, Dr. Khan, that she told him that, why wouldn't that be negligence on his part apart from customary, apart from the standard of care issue?
Because there was no duty on him. There must be some kind
of
a duty.
If the resident comes to the attending physician and says, you know, this patient looks in terrible shape, I don't know what to do, I think you should examine him yourself. And he says, well, no, the rule doesn't require me to do so, so I'm not going to. So you say a case like that, there's no liability?
I think that sometimes there may be liability if the level is high enough.
Excuse me? Not in my hypothetical case.
In your hypothetical case, I wouldn't think so.
If
he says, I think he looks...
That's ridiculous.
No, if the resident, who after all is a medical
don't
doctor...
Don't change my facts.
I'm not.
I gave you a hypothetical case.
And I believe what you said was that the resident said that the individual looked sick. That could mean that he had a high temperature.
That's not what I just said. You wouldn't listen to me. I said the resident says to the doctor, this patient looks really bad. I think you should examine him. And the attending physician says, no, I don't have to. And you say there's no liability.
I would think that there is a sliding scale here. If the seriousness is not that he has a bad cold, for example, that it is something that seems like it is more severe, then there might be such a requirement.
My problem with the case is the fact that, I fully comprehend that no second-year resident would ever have been able to diagnose the particular malady that Mr. Arpin was suffering from. I absolutely accept that. But my problem is why they didn't keep him. How do you send such a person home?
I don't know, Your Honor. And, of course, the individual for whom we are responsible, the government, never saw the patient.
Yes, this is the problem, of course, right?
Well, that is.
Well, it's hard to create a defense out of, you know, refusing to see the patient.
He didn't refuse to see the patient.
Well, if you believe what Dr. As I understand, correct me if I'm wrong, the judge believed Dr. Khan that she told Haynes things about the patient which Haynes agrees that if she had told him, of course he disagrees that she told him, but if she told him, yes, he would have wanted to.
Only one thing, Your Honor, and that was that his pain had increased. And that is what the entire argument rests on.
Well, is it your position then that increasing pain is not a symptom that should have triggered greater scrutiny?
That it should not have triggered a requirement that the preceptor see the patient. Now, let me just add one thing before my time is gone, and that is that the district court recognized the existence of the primary care exception. What he said was that something overcame that exception, and that something was what he called the individualization of supervision requirement. That is how the United States was made liable in a situation where otherwise it would not have been. And the individualization of supervision is something that was made up in this case It does not exist at law. It is no different than to say that there was incompetent supervision. And if that is going to be the test for when the primary care exception exists in residency programs in the United States, then I would suggest that the primary care exception has been wiped out of medical education. And that is the important aspect of this case that we are bringing to the court's attention.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cole. Mr. Zittel?
It pleases the court, your honors, counsel, Mr. Keefe, Mr. Cole, Mr. Hipkiss. My name is Matt Zittel. For the purposes of my argument this morning, I am limiting my issue to whether or not the district court made a mistake in finding that Dr. Khan deviated from the standard of care. It is my position and my client's position that Dr. Khan did not deviate from the standard of care. Judge, you did ask a question earlier,
right, about... Right, and it should have been directed to you.
And that's perfectly understandable, and I will do my best to answer that question. Yes, the family did make claims of associated symptoms or signs of infection when Mr. Arpin presented to the Belleville Family Practice Clinic. It is Dr. Khan's testimony that the family never made such claims or never gave such a history, and that upon examination of the patient...
It doesn't matter what she says, right?
Well,
judge had to resolve the credibility issue.
Agreed, Your Honor. He had the job to resolve the credibility issue, but based upon other evidence, Dr. Khan's testimony is entirely plausible and credible.
Well, it doesn't matter whether it's plausible. It wasn't believed by the trier of fact.
Judge, I would submit that in that instance that the Judge Herndon was mistaken with his... finding of Judge Khan's credibility, and by looking at other evidence...
How can you say that?
Well, her testimony was corroborated by the triage nurse's testimony, Nurse Pamela Asbury, who was...
You can have 10 witnesses testifying to one thing and one witness testifying to the other, to the opposite, and if the judge or jury believes the witness, the one against the 10, then... We're generally bound by that, unless you can point out some objective evidence which shows that these relatives must have been lying.
Well, the emergency room record of September 26 also points out that a history was given.
The fact that he died does suggest, rather, that he would have displayed these symptoms.
It does suggest, Judge, but I don't think it's as clear as you believe, given the timing of the events, that also a needle biopsy was performed by Dr. Schroeder on the 26th that yielded only 1 to 2 cc's of fluid. And the experts, or at least one expert, had testified that that particular characterization of the fluid did not indicate, didn't have pus, therefore it was not, it was more of a new infection, and therefore... lends additional weight to the argument that the infection was not present upon presentation to Dr. Khan, and that her findings or lack of findings as to his physical condition was accurate. Also, Dr. Khan's findings upon physical examination are important to note. The experts also testified that when someone has a psoas abscess involvement, that typically the rotation of their leg would be an external rotation to relieve the pain from the psoas involvement. In this particular case, Dr. Khan examined the patient and found that his rotation was internal, which is actually something that the district court found, that it was an indicator that points away from a psoas pathology, i.e. that there were not, in addition to the lack of symptoms of a psoas infection, that this particular examination finding also points away from psoas involvement, and therefore it could not have been diagnosed by Dr. Khan at that time, and that she did not violate the
standard. It doesn't matter whether it's psoas or something else. I mean, it's related to Judge Rovner's question. If it's clear that the patient is in a bad situation with the pain and the relatives say were signs of fever, the clamminess and sweatiness and so on, then you'd think the doctors would want, a responsible doctor would say, you know, we have to keep an eye on this person. We don't want to send him home. Apparently he wasn't in great shape physically. How old was he?
I believe he was 54, Your Honor.
And he was diabetic and he weighed 254 pounds. How tall was he?
Judge, I don't know the answer to that question.
Strange. People put in these weight figures in our cases, and they never tell us how tall the person is.
Apologize for that, Judge. But nevertheless, Judge, Dr. Kahn's obligation at that point was to examine the patient, which she did. She reported her findings. She made those report to her preceptor. And it is our position, as my time is probably getting ready to run out, that Dr. Kahn did not deviate from the standard of care. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Zittel. Mr. Keefe?
Yes, sir. May it please the court. In response to your question, Justice Posner, is that the primary exception, I don't have any idea what the primary exception rule is. I don't know where it came from. What I know is the law of the state of Illinois is that in order to establish a medical malpractice case, you have to demonstrate there was a deviation from the standard of care. In addition to that is that you then have to first establish what is the standard of care. And the law is clear that the standard of care can be demonstrated in lots of ways. You noted one, custom, practice, bylaws, hospital regulations, testimony of expert witnesses, but perhaps the most probative and persuasive demonstration of the standard of care comes from whom? The doctor himself.
Wait a second.
Huh?
You mean each individual doctor sets a standard of care?
Judge, you said the law of the state of Illinois, as it's been announced by the Supreme Court in a case called Walsky versus Tuzinski, 1978, has always been, is that there's no one better able to establish the standard of care than the witness himself who's being accused of deviating from the standard of care. Who would know better than the witness how he should be practicing medicine?
What cases indicate where a doctor in the state of Illinois has ever acknowledged that he or she has deviated from the standard of care in a piece of litigation?
Which case? I'm sorry.
I'm asking you, is there such a case? Is it just we have to presume every doctor who ever testifies in a medical mal case is going to testify as to the standard of care in an accurate and a complete way?
No,
sir. You're saying every physician in the state of Illinois has the capacity to set the standard of care, and it can deviate from any other doctor. He or she can make the assessment in the individual case, and that becomes the standard of care for that case.
I'm suggesting, Your Honor, is that what the law would say is that proof of the standard of care can be in the form of admissions from the defendant. Many people don't choose to get those admissions, or perhaps they're unable to get those admissions. But the law in the state of Illinois has always been that an admission from the defendant is one way to prove a deviation from the standard of care. The physician himself is certainly competent as a witness to establish what.
I'm not suggesting.
Okay.
I'm just suggesting that he or she creates the standard of care for that case?
No, sir. He does not create the creation of standard of care. Standard of care is something which is established by evidence. And there are different manners of proving the standard of care.
No question.
One of those manners is an admission from the defendant. Another manner is an admission or statements offered by expert witnesses. Another manner would be hospital rules, regulations, you know, Joint Commission on Hospital Standards. Those are all accepted ways of establishing the standard.
Well, when you say you've never heard of the primary care exception, you mean this wasn't testified to in the case?
Oh, no. When I say it, I had never. When you asked, Your Honor, about the primary care exception, certainly there was testimony to it. There was testimony from one of the experts who said that the primary care exception represents the standard of care in this case. There was testimony from another witness that said that does not represent the standard of care in this case. And most importantly, there was testimony from Dr. Haynes, who repeatedly acknowledged that the standard of care did not include the primary care exception because he acknowledged is that his duty to supervise must be individualized based upon what he knows about that resident, her fund of knowledge, her technical skills, her capacity, you know, how well she communicates.
There are two concepts of individualized supervision which have to be distinguished. One is the notion that the attending physician has a duty actually to study the resident and her, you know, what she knows, and, you know, do an individual investigation of some sort. That, I think, is extreme. The other conception of individualized supervision is if you know something about the resident or you know something about the patient, about the situation, of course you have to respond to what you know. Is that your conception of individualized supervision, or do you think that yes, the attending physician has to familiarize himself with the educational background and this everything else of an interview and so on, the residents?
My conception of it, Your Honor, is the latter, what you've just suggested. I believe in this case the evidence is that Dr. Haynes knew nothing about Dr. Kahn. He never met her, never evaluated her work, didn't know what her level of skill was. But having said that, is that he did, according to the evidence, and the United States has acknowledged it in their brief, he acknowledges that he was told by Dr. Kahn that the patient had increasing pain. And again,
now that I understand, that's separate from the question of investigating your residents.
Then my response to that question is yes, because I think it's just that, you know.
What about the clamminess and the sweatiness? Did the relatives testify that they told Dr. Kahn?
Absolutely.
But she didn't testify, did she, or did she, that she told that to Captain Haynes?
Dr. Kahn did not tell that to Captain Haynes, which was one of Captain Haynes' criticisms of Dr. Kahn.
So all Dr. Haynes knew was that the pain was increasing, and your argument is that that should have been enough to induce him to examine.
And the basis, yes, sir, and the basis for that argument is found on page 34 of volume 1 of the a transcript where I asked Dr. Haynes directly. So you would agree that if we take Ron Arpin as he was presented to you, and then we add that Ron Arpin equation, quote, plus increasing pain, close quote, you, as a reasonably prudent physician, would have and should have seen the patient. Is that right? And his answer on page 34 was yes.
Beginning of that question.
So you would agree that if we take Ron Arpin, and by that I'm saying is that there was a dispute. Dr. Haynes indicated at one point he wasn't told. He said at another point he couldn't recall. He said at another point this is that maybe he was told. So what I was suggesting to him is
maybe he was told what?
About the increasing pain.
About the increasing pain, but not about the clamminess and the
dispute that he wasn't
told.
So
you're saying that he admitted that if he were told about the increasing pain, he would have done something?
He admitted that he not only would have done something, he admitted that a reasonably prudent physician should have done something. And that is evidence of what I mean by the standard of care.
Do you think we could talk about these damages?
Yes, ma'am.
Because I've been wondering whether it's your position that because Illinois law controls and Illinois courts seem to conduct little to no comparisons or limitations regarding damages, that our review is essentially non-existent. I've been trying to figure out what review you're seeking here. In other words, what's the standard by which you would have us judge whether these damages are acceptable?
I would suggest that standard is articulated by this court in a case called Davis versus United States, decided in 2004, where this court held the district court damage award cannot be overturned unless it's factual basis.
But what about this statute? It was cited in passing by somebody, but maybe it's inapplicable. It says, but there's an Illinois statute that says in any medical malpractice action, case of award against a hospital and its personnel or hospital affiliates, total amount of non-economic damages shall not exceed $1 million.
Your Honor, that was a statute which has been adopted and with an effective date a full 2 years, a full 4 years following the ARP.
Oh, so it isn't applicable.
There's no applicability whatsoever. It's a statute that was passed and signed by the governor in August of 2000.
But where did the $8 million come from?
Well,
I mean, where will I find why Judge Herndon, you know, what's the benchmark to how he arrived at that figure?
Your Honor, I would answer that question in a couple of fashions. One way I would answer it is that I would suggest is that under Illinois law, as I've indicated, is that the issue is clearly erroneous. But if we look at Illinois reported decisions, there is a case called Holston versus Sisters of the Third Order of St. Francis, where the Supreme Court more than 12 years ago upheld an award of $6.2 million for the wrongful death of a mother and her two children.
Well, yeah, but that's a young mother with two young children. Here we have, you know, a 54-year-old man with three adult children.
Four
adult children.
And I would say...
all on their own.
Well, yes and no.
I know there's one that has, you know, emotional problems.
There's one who has emotional problems. It was a very close-knit family. And, of course, the reality is, Your Honor, is that Judge Herndon heard the testimony, and I would also partially respond, other than perhaps drawing your attention to a couple other Supreme Court cases, I would respond this way, Judge. I would also respond is that the basis for this damage award is that he heard the testimony. He made a judgment about this family's loss. He was sitting there. He saw it. Much as this court said in Davis, this is that the appellate court, even though they may disagree with what the judge ruled, is that unless they determine that that ruling was clearly erroneous. But let me suggest this as well.
Can we use the statute as some indication of Illinois public policy?
No, sir.
Why not?
Because if that is public policy, it was a public policy that was announced.
No, but it's, you know, it's there's a national trend toward capping malpractice awards. And why can't the courts reflect it and say in 2007 these astronomical non-economic damages just don't comport with what people think is reasonable because of health costs and so on?
I would say a couple of answers to that. First answer is that
this statute would cap no matter how many plaintiffs you have. The total award could be only $1 million. So now we have what, $7 million here?
Eight.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, that's quite a...
Well, Judge, it is, of course, if we accept the premise that the law that governed not only...
I'm not suggesting that an inapplicable statute governs. I'm raising the question whether the statute shows something about how people nowadays are thinking about these problems, and maybe the district judge was just not sufficiently sensitive to the, you know, atmosphere of how people think about these things. Because, I mean, pursuing Judge Rovner's question, could he have awarded $16 million?
Probably not, based upon the findings announced by the Illinois Supreme Court as to what did or did not shock the conscience. Supreme Court of Illinois, which also articulates public policy, in three separate decisions, along with the appellate court, have announced that awards of similar amount do not shock the judicial conscience, and that's the standard.
Would you remind me how much was... set against each of the defendants?
It was a joint and several.
So it was joint and several.
Yes, ma'am.
Now, I take it you would agree that no second-year resident could have diagnosed Mr. Arpin.
Judge, I would like to agree with you because... I figure if I agree with you, maybe I could talk to you on the damage thing, but I cannot agree with you simply because of what the doctor herself testified to. I mean, Dr. Kahn was specifically asked in my examination, she was specifically asked that very question. I asked her on page 21 of volume 2, I asked her specifically, based upon your history, based upon your physical exam, based upon your experience, based upon your fund of knowledge, based upon your knowledge of anatomy, based upon your knowledge of the psoas muscle and the psoas abscess, and based upon your knowledge as to what is and not important regarding history and physical examination, and based upon your knowledge of the importance of vital signs, there is no doubt in your mind that this man had nothing going on with his psoas muscle and specifically did not have a psoas abscess. Is that right? Answer, at the time I saw him, no, sir. And then I said to her specifically, you would expect that you would have been capable, with a reasonably prudent history and exam, of diagnosing that condition if he had it. Line 21, she answered, yes, sir. In addition to that, I said, you would expect that if he had any indication of a psoas abscess at the time of your evaluation, you believe that a reasonably prudent history and physical examination by you would either have led you to a suspicion that would have caused you to order additional tests that would have diagnosed it, or you would have diagnosed it. Is that true? And she answered, yes, sir. So that's the only reason.
Of course, none of the experts thought that a second-year resident could do that.
That is correct.
Right.
And I'd also point out in response to what Mr. Zittel said about the issue of whether there was or was not a psoas abscess there. There was. And the best evidence of that is Dr. Haynes.
We have different standards of care for residents and attending physicians.
Yes, I think there are different standards of care. I think there are. And I think that the testimony as to what constitutes a standard, and that's why Dr.
Pop. The lower the standard of care for the residents, the higher the standard of care for the attending physician.
Right? That's the idea. Right. But see, that's the notion of teaching. And the notion of teaching is preceptory. And again, if I could only make one final comment on damages, Your Honor, in response to your question. Judge, please understand, they did not defend damages in this case. I mean,
They
offered no defense on damages. Let me tell you everything that was said by the United States of America during the course of that entire trial as to damages. It says, now the plaintiff filed an administrative claim against the United States in this case for $11 million, $10 million for wrongful death, and $1 million for survival or personal injury claim. The damages should be less than what the plaintiff asked for. That's the only thing the government ever said about damages.
What did you ask for?
I asked for $5 million for Jeannie, and I asked for $1 million each as to each of the children, and in addition to that, I asked for $1 million on the survival count. And the judge awarded
$10 million.
I asked for 10, and the judge awarded
me
less.
What about the university? Did they ask for, did they specify damages for you?
No, sir, but I happen to have that right here. Is that they said, and this is the only thing St. Louis University ever said about damages. Closing argument. Your Honor, my heart, the university's heart, absolutely goes out to the Arkins. I mean, anyone that would deny that doesn't have a heart. And I feel horribly for them for their loss. Mr. Keefe is correct. You don't have to prep these witnesses. It is very amazing what this family feels for this man, and justifiably so. Page 118, this is all they said. Mr. Keefe suggested certain figures to you. I believe they're high. I can only ask you to do something that I know you will. If you get to that point, be fair. I know you will be.
Mr. Keefe,
yes,
in Barry versus Owens Corning, one of the cases you cited,
yes, sir.
Do you have an indication as to the age of those
children?
Yes, sir.
Children? The man was 40.
I know he was 59. The children?
Yes, sir. The children were adult children.
And all adult children?
Yes, sir. And each of those children, the awards for those children range from $500,000 for one of the children. The remaining two got $600,000, and the other two got $750,000. And I'd also point out that case was decided in 1996.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Keith.
Thank you.
Mr. Cole, Mr. Zittel, your time expired, but we'll give you each a minute if you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think the only thing I'd like to mention in closing is that what opposing counsel just explained about how the United States becomes liable in this case is that since Dr. Pollack's testimony did not even go to the issue of primary care exception, that was Dr. Pollack was his witness, because he didn't know anything about that and was not he wasn't a primary care physician and had no experience in that, that he draws on the testimony of Dr. Haynes, the government physician, and says he is the source of the law that governs the case. That, I suggest, is absurd. You cannot take the testimony from the opposing party, someone who declares his innocence, says, I did not practice below the standard of care, but who admits that, yes, I think I am required to give competent supervision, and I think I did give competent supervision, and have that result in a decision where the court...
It's an admission, as you said.
An admission of something that the
look, if you ask someone a
hypothetical,
of course, that's what a hypothetical question is, right? You say, you know, if you say to a witness, if you had known X, would you have been required by the standard of care to do Y? And he says yes, and then you prove X, you have an admission.
That's yes, of course, he didn't say that.
Perfectly. Look, he correct that you and the lawyer for the university said nothing about the damages except that they were high?
Your Honor, the damages the only damages that we are contesting here are for loss of consortium. That's it. How much did the family feel?
What did you say to the jury? What did you say to the judge?
We didn't say anything about loss of consortium.
Anything, for goodness sake. If you didn't say anything, what basis do you have for complaining about the damages?
Because loss of consortium is nothing about which we can say anything.
I mean, well, that's ridiculous.
How much does the loss of a husband mean? Is it a million? Is it 2 million? Is it a billion? I don't know.
If you don't know, then when the judge says a billion, what do you argue?
You say it must be within the realm of reason.
What is that? But you have no content. You have made no effort to put content into that or shocking the conscience. Now, what you could do, you could say to the judge, look, we've looked at all these other cases, and we've seen in all these other cases, yes, the very generous rewards, I'm picking up what Judge Fong was asking about, very generous rewards when you have minor children. But when you have a middle-aged guy with adult children, the consortium award, loss of consortium in the neighborhood of 50 to 100,000, and there's nothing in this case that would justify, say, more than doubling that. You could have done all that, but I gather from Mr. Key, you didn't do anything like that. You
that's
left
right.
Judge Herndon.
But that's no evidence. That's obvious argument. And I don't think that argument...
It's argument or evidence. It's what you tell a judge when he has responsibility for assessing damages in these, you know,
and we make arguments
intangible areas.
We make arguments about the amount of income that may be involved in the case.
It's not about income, right?
That's right. It's not about something
that
is
comparable. The point is, if you treat it as simply a discretionary call for the trier of fact, then you have very little basis for arguing with what the judge does.
Are you saying then that when the government is before district courts, that we, whenever presented with a loss of consortium request, that we should be arguing how much the life of a human being is worth?
Yeah, but Mr. Cole, could you not, by citing cases that have gone before, give some framework as to range? So that the context of the damages, perhaps in the case one we're arguing before the judge, the judge could relate to those. I mean, there might be an outlier case, but just by giving some statistical analysis of the last decade or two.
Certainly.
I mean,
we could do that, and you know, that is really something where we are unaware whether the court is even going to award damages for pain and suffering or for loss of consortium.
Responsible. Look, because if you look at cases on damages, when we're asked to cut down damages, when we do cut down damages, we do it primarily on the basis of what other courts have done. As Judge Fahm says, you get some sense of community, you know, legal community consensus on these various awards. if you don't argue on that basis, then you have nothing to say.
We have argued before this court on precisely that basis.
Your problem here, it seems to me, is one that that everyone is dancing around, and that is that Judge Herndon was so wildly sympathetic to the plaintiffs that my feeling has been all along that you were afraid to discuss dollar figures.
I wasn't there at the time, Your Honor, but that is a possibility.
Yeah, all the more reason, Mr. Cole, and the government doesn't need advice from me, but all the more reason if you have a judge that apparently in a bench trial is displaying, if that occurred here, some degree of concern about the case beyond what might be dispassionate with another jurist. All the more reason, it seems to me, trial counsel, and I appreciate you come from the distinguished appellate section of justice, and I say that admiringly, but all the more reason that you need to guide that judge. We have a lot of models of district judges, as we do appellate judges across this country, and the great asset we would have is the government advancing some framework, I think.
I will take that advice back with me.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. Mr. Zittel, do you have anything further? Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much to all of the council. And